Friday, 21st of May, the coronavirus death toll in Latin America and the Caribbean surpassed the 1 million mark as the outbreak deteriorated in that part of the world with the highest per capita fatality rate. The top 8 countries registering the most COVID-19 deaths per capita over the past days were all in Latin America. On average, 31% of the coronavirus deaths across the globe this month have been in Latin America and the Caribbean, home to only 8.4% of the world's population. The head of the COVID-19 program at one of Mexico's main hospitals, Dr. Francisco Moreno Sanchez, who is also a key critic of the government's vaccination plan, said, "Instead of preparing for the pandemic, we minimized the disease, saying that tropical heat would deactivate the virus." He said, "Unfortunately, we're among the most affected regions, where the handling of the pandemic has been the most mistaken, and now we are suffering the consequences. In Peru, which is among the hardest hit nations in the region, COVID-19 patients have died in crowded hospital corridors of the capital Lima. This is while deep in the Amazon jungles of Brazil, many residents of the city of Manaus have died at home with no oxygen to fill damaged lungs after supplies ran out this year. Most of the deaths across South America, more than 446,000 deaths, have occurred in Brazil, which became a COVID-19 epicenter this year with the second deadliest outbreak outside of the United States. Brazil's health ministry announced on Friday, 21st of May, the country registered 2,215 new deaths from the contagion in the past 24 hours, pushing Latin America's total above the 1 million mark. The government of Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, a vaccine skeptic and opponent of lockdowns, is being investigated by a parliamentary commission for failing to plan a national drive against COVID-19 and not buying vaccines in time. Brazil remains the third most affected country in the world in terms of confirmed COVID-19 cases, behind only India and the United States. It has the highest death toll in the region, followed by Mexico and Colombia, which combined represent about 74% of all deaths in Latin America. A Brazilian senator leading the upper house's inquiry into the government's handling of the crisis said recently, "President Jair Bolsonaro never wanted to purchase COVID-19 vaccines and originally bet on herd immunity beating the coronavirus." Senator Renan Calheiros added in an interview that it is too early to say if Jair Bolsonaro has committed any criminal offense in his management of the public health crisis, and that more investigation is required. Senator Calheiro said, "The president first denied the disease, called it a flu, and then argued against social isolation and lockdown. Then he played down the use of wearing face masks and encouraged crowds to gather." He added, "Why is that? Because of herd immunity, the natural immunity you have to encourage crowds and the spread of the virus." Calheiro said of Bolsonaro, "This is why he never wanted a vaccine," noting that the president was slow in spending billions of dollars given to him by Congress earlier in the pandemic to buy vaccines from overseas. Herd immunity occurs when a large portion of a given population achieves immunity to a disease, sometimes through widespread infection, thereby reducing the chances of person-to-person spread. Bolsonaro has drawn criticism from detractors in Brazil due to his efforts to minimize the dangers of the coronavirus, shunning face masks and push unproven remedies. Vaccinations in South America lag behind much of the world. In South America, just 15% of the people have received at least one dose of the vaccine, compared with 28% in Europe and 34% in North America. According to the World Health Organization figure, through to 19th of May, only Asia and Africa are lower at 5% and 1% respectively. The Pan American Health Organization has slammed glaring gaps in access to COVID-19 vaccines in Latin America. The Pan American Health Organization director, Carissa Etienne, said recently, "Just 3% of Latin Americans have been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. We urgently need more vaccines." Vaccine supplies have been slow to arrive in most countries, and inoculation programs have been disorganized in several countries. Pediatric surgeon Kurt Paulson, who runs a vaccination site in Latin America region, said, "Vaccination has lacked strategic planning. At first, they bought lots of different vaccines with no information to show people what they are being injected with."
The subcontinent.
Hello everyone, this is Mehdi and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the government, people, organizations and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people alike.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the future of the United States troops in the region following the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Then we will explore alternative scenarios for Washington to maintain its military presence in the region.
The United States has postponed the withdrawal of its military forces from Afghanistan yet again. The Biden administration has said the troops would leave the country before the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. However, the deadline seems more symbolic than pragmatic, considering the recent rise in terrorist attacks across Afghanistan. After 2 decades of military presence in the country, the U.S. seems to be left with no good options.
Late in February 2020, the United States and the Taliban signed a peace agreement in Qatar's Doha. The accord was officially titled the Agreement for Bringing Peace to Afghanistan, but the Afghan government was excluded from the talks. As per the provisions of the deal, Washington promised the complete withdrawal of all American and NATO troops from Afghanistan if Taliban prevents Al-Qaeda and other terrorist outfits from operating against the U.S. and its allies. Taliban also promised to engage in talks with the Afghan government and distance itself from Al-Qaeda. The United States agreed to an initial reduction of its force level from 13,000 to 8,600 by July 2020, followed by a full withdrawal by the 1st of May 2021 if the Taliban keeps its commitments. Although Taliban failed to hold up its end of the deal, Washington went on and completed its reduction of forces to 2,500 troops in January. This is the lowest number of American soldiers in Afghanistan since 2001. Many experts believe that such a low number of troops cannot have any operational value on the ground, but it could be used as a political leverage in the U.S. negotiations with Taliban. However, President Joe Biden did not use this as a bargaining chip and announced plans for the full withdrawal of the remaining 2,500 troops on September 11th, the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. According to the plan, NATO troops would also follow the same withdrawal timeline.
The United States has numerous military bases throughout the world. Now may be the time to use them. The Biden administration might be looking for some alternatives to keep the American foothold in the region, to provide security for the U.S. interests and gather intelligence in Afghanistan. The U.S. needs to reside its forces close by.
The United States is now bogged down in an attrition warfare in Afghanistan and only has bad choices. No possible scenarios can be favorable for Washington. If it leaves Afghanistan for good, it loses its stand in the region after two decades of useless and costly occupation. Moreover, the U.S. has massive amount of assets and military equipment in Afghanistan that may end up in the hands of terrorists following the pullout. Furthermore, how can Washington know if Taliban is keeping up with its commitments without the proper intelligence gathering operations? The U.S. is doomed to failure in this quagmire that it has created in Afghanistan. There is no victory in this war, as all future possibilities lead to different levels of defeat for Washington. Therefore, the U.S. will have to either find ways to linger its presence in the country or find alternatives that are less costly. It may opt for a stronger diplomatic mission, for example, through a castle embassy in Kabul or an army of contractors across the country. According to figures from U.S. Central Command, there are more than 7 contractors for each U.S. military service member remaining in Afghanistan, amounting to over 18,000 contractors as of January 2021. Another alternative may be relocating forces to its numerous military bases in Asia.
I think everybody recognizes that the previous administration in the United States under President Donald Trump signed a peace treaty with the Taliban, which set a May 1st, 2021 deadline for the withdrawal of all foreign troops. That's not just American troops, but also the 7,000 plus NATO troops that are currently deployed in Afghanistan. If you check the calendar, it's past May 1st, and the Taliban have made it clear that they view this as a violation. Now, the Taliban will be clever. They're not going to do anything that will provoke the United States to keep its forces inside Afghanistan, but they also recognize that the United States is in a very sensitive political environment where, you know, we've committed to leave Afghanistan, and so the Taliban will exploit this withdrawal to try and gain military and political advantage inside Afghanistan. So they are going to be carrying out attacks against primarily Afghan security forces, but these attacks may end up involving some American, some NATO targets. But again, I believe that the Taliban would seek to minimize violence against Americans and NATO forces because they want them out of the country.
The U.S. military has presence on every continent. For most of the recent history, the U.S. claimed some existing threat and set up a military base in a region near the source of the alleged threat. But it almost never left the base afterwards. There is no exact public number for the U.S. military bases outside of its borders, but some sources say the number is between 500 and 800 in over 80 countries. It splits the world in 6 regions, each with its own permanent and temporary bases. Map of the bases, you see the greatest concentration of overseas bases are near Russia's population center in the east, in the Middle East, and in East Asia. These bases are everything from massive military compounds the size of towns to small airstrips in the middle of the ocean. If the United States continues its airstrikes or other so-called counterterrorism operations in the region following the supposed withdrawal from Afghanistan, it needs to be close, so all the neighbors of Afghanistan and other regional countries can be viable destinations. Some of them seem more favorable than others, such as Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, as well as Pakistan and India.
Pundits believe it is naive to think that the U.S. will leave the region for good, so its next move may involve occupying another country in the region or increasing its military presence in another country. The U.S. Central Command and American diplomats are negotiating with nations surrounding Afghanistan on agreements to base troops and aircraft for operations inside the country following the withdrawal. CENTCOM boss General Kenneth McKenzie says the command is engaged in a significant effort aimed at determining the best places for the troops. Earlier in the Afghan war, the U.S. military had agreements to operate out of large bases in locations such as Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, but it is not yet decided which countries could be considered. As a strategic friend, Pakistan seems a very plausible option, but has many obstacles because it is so close that Taliban would not see it as far enough.
After 9/11, there was a different dynamic. The United States was in the revenge business. And if you stood in our way, we were going to crush you. End of story, no debate, it was going to happen. And Pakistan knew this. So even though Pakistan didn't want the United States operating, and remember that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were affiliated with the Pakistani intelligence services. They were receiving aid and training and equipment, and they were operating as a proxy of Pakistan. Pakistan didn't necessarily want the United States to be operating, but they had no choice because they recognized the United States had to go in and exact its revenge. And so Pakistan opened up its territory. It allowed the United States to use some of its bases to operate out of. But more importantly, it allowed the United States to use its port facilities to deliver the tremendous amount of logistics, the vehicles, the fuel, the equipment were all shipped into Pakistan and trucked over into Afghanistan. And to this day, Pakistan has never totally shut that down. They've made noises, it's been difficult, some of the convoys have been blown up, and the United States was forced to go to Russia, of all places, and get the northern transit route, from Russia, across Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, into Afghanistan that way.
The countries that Washington already has bases, or some military agreements like Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, are other choices for the destination of the U.S. forces.
Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan are viable options if their governments open the bases up to the United States and if Russia continues to allow the United States to supply these bases from Russian territory. The United States would ship, and the way this worked is the United States shipped material into the Black Sea. They landed at Georgian ports, and then they were shipped by rail from Georgia onto Russian territory, and then on to Turkmenistan, through Turkmenistan, and into Uzbekistan. American military airlift capability was allowed to overfly Russian territory. The last time I checked, the United States and Russia aren't getting along too well. And I don't think Russia is going to be inclined to allow the United States to continue to have this kind of access. So without that access, without Russia saying, yes, you can use our territory to supply your bases in Uzbekistan, there are no bases in Uzbekistan.
India may also be Biden's solution. The Indian subcontinent is where the Biden administration is scrutinizing to find a hot sweet spot for the future of the forces. India seems like a place that Taliban would agree.
Of course, the U.S. may be able to find a way to pull out of the accord and not out of the country. Biden may opt to cite Taliban violations or delays in peace talks with the Afghan government as justification for maintaining an indefinite military presence or ask the Taliban for an extension of the withdrawal deadline. In any case, this means the escalation of war in Afghanistan.
The United States' negotiation with Taliban after 20 years of war is getting more and more like surrender talks. Washington has no leverage against the Taliban. It has no way to guarantee Taliban would not move to gain control over the country. Nobody is sure of Afghan security forces' capability to counter the increasing terrorist attacks in the country. Also, there is nothing to ensure that Kabul can survive the resurgence of Takfiri terrorists in the region. Many experts say if Washington had wanted to start negotiations with Taliban, it should have done it, for example, back in 2004, when the U.S. had the upper hand in the conflict. Some others say American authorities and policymakers should start learning how to end a war rather than starting never-ending wars.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by John Kiraku, American author, journalist, and retired intelligence officer. John, welcome to the program. Now let's start by asking this. Will the American forces leave Afghanistan for good? And if they do, where would they go, back home or to another U.S. base in the region?
Yes, I think that this is the real deal. I think they are going to leave. Most of them will probably come back to bases in the United States. These troops will not be relocated to bases in the region. Is that the United States negotiates troop levels with each country. And so let's say there are 500 troops at a base in, let's say, Saudi Arabia, then the limit is set at 500. If troops are leaving Afghanistan, they can't then go to Saudi Arabia because it would violate the agreement. They would have to go back to the United States or to these very large bases that we have in Germany.
Why were the U.S. forces in Afghanistan in the first place? Did they achieve their goals now that they seem to be leaving? How do you see the future of Afghanistan after the foreign troops withdrawal?
Let me answer the first part of your question first. The purpose, the sole purpose for entering Afghanistan was to destroy al-Qaeda. According to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, that mission was accomplished by the end of 2001. In fact, by the end of 2001, there were no more than 50 al-Qaeda fighters left in Afghanistan. We had either killed them, caught them, or pushed them out into Pakistan or to their home countries. So there was no reason to remain in Afghanistan after the end of 2001. In terms of the future of the Afghan government, I'm not at all optimistic. And frankly, I blame the Afghans for this. You know, the United States spent about $1 trillion in Afghanistan over the last 20 years. That's a staggering amount of money. And we have nothing to show for it. We are leaving Afghanistan as a country that's unable to defend itself. It's a country that has a central government that is so weak that its officials can't even leave the capital itself. It's subject to terrorist attacks from a multitude of groups. It has poor relations with its immediate neighbors. In my view, this has been really a failure of policy over the last 20 years. And let me tell you one other thing, just as an example. The United States, about 15 years ago, hired an American defense contractor to train the Afghan National Police. They created a police academy where they could train these people, and it included a dormitory where recruits were sleeping. One of the recruits was secretly a member of the Taliban. Now, he had not been vetted. None of these recruits had been vetted. And what he did was he put poison in stew that was fed to the recruits at dinner. He killed more than a dozen of them. And many of the ones that didn't die by poisoning, he killed that night while they were sleeping. Now, after all these years, these are the issues that we still have to deal with? To me, this shows just a complete and total failure from the very beginning.
Thank you, John. We'll just give you a little break and let's take a look at how the global media has covered the issue.
President Joe Biden says the United States met its objective of attacking Afghanistan 10 years ago with the assassination of Osama bin Laden, adding that since then, our reasons for staying have become increasingly unclear, with a terror threat now in many places, keeping thousands of troops grounded and concentrated in just one country and across the billions of dollars spent each year, makes little sense to me and to our leaders, Biden said. Provincial officials from across Afghanistan have warned of mounting losses in a series of attacks, some with heavy casualties, since the United States officially began its withdrawal on May 1st. But the Pentagon insists that the withdrawal was going according to plan, with no surprises. It's not a foregone conclusion in my professional military estimate that the Taliban automatically win and Kabul falls, General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told reporters at the Pentagon. Although troops will leave, the Pentagon, American spy agencies, and American allies will maintain a less visible presence in the country. The departure will not include the 1,000 troops maintained in the country off the books, as Pentagon sources told the New York Times, including elite Army Rangers working for both the Pentagon and the CIA. More troops will remain positioned in neighboring countries, and attack planes will be within rapid reach, forewarned of insurgent fighters by armed surveillance drones. Civilian contractors may also play a role on the ground.
Thank you, John, for your wait. And now we have more questions for you, obviously. If the U.S. removes its troops from Afghanistan, will it increase its number of forces in neighboring countries such as Pakistan?
I don't think there will be an increase in the number of troops at bases in the region, especially in Pakistan. And that's because we have a very difficult relationship with Pakistan. You know, I served there in 2002, and the Pakistanis are of two minds of the United States. One, they cooperate with us like brothers on the issue of counterterrorism. On other issues, we have a very difficult relationship with Pakistan, to the point where they don't trust us on broader international issues, international affairs. They trust the Chinese. They have a closer relationship with the Chinese, economics, trade, foreign affairs, defense cooperation. But, you know, the United States abandoned Pakistan in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan was president because we had pushed the Russians out. And that was really our goal. It was very short-sighted. And so we just walked away from the Pakistanis. And then we went back to them in 2001 and we said, hey, we need your help again. Well, should they trust us? Are we reliable allies? I think the answer is no, at least not where the Pakistanis are concerned. Now, the Gulf states, we have very close relations with the Gulf states, but there's really no reason to increase U.S. troop strength there. You know, there's a joke here in the United States. Perhaps you've seen it on social media. It's a map of the Persian Gulf, and it has little American flags wherever there's an American base. And, of course, the bases go all the way around Iran. And it says, look at the Iranians. They put their country right in the middle of our bases.
John, this last question. Will the Biden administration consider India as bases for U.S. troops to keep their eye on the situation in Afghanistan?
I don't think the Biden administration will consider India a viable option for a couple of reasons. First of all, the Indians have never invited us, which is a big deal. We've worked hard over the years to improve relations with India, beginning during the Clinton administration. Traditionally, we had very poor relations with India because they were close to the Soviet Union. When the Soviets fell and Bill Clinton was president, he decided to open this new relationship, and it's worked. You know, we have millions of Indians living in the United States. Many of them have become American citizens. So there's this this cultural and familial tie already. But the relationship that we have is really built on trade and defense sales. We sell a lot of jets and weapons and things like that. But that's not to say that the Indians want us to actually be in India, and so they've never invited us. With that said, it would cause a huge problem in our relations with Pakistan if we were to send troops to India. This is what I meant when I said we have this difficult relationship with Pakistan. It's almost like a love-hate relationship. They don't want us to be there, but they don't want us to be in India more. And so if they were to choose the lesser of two evils, they would rather have us in Pakistan so that we would be paying them instead of paying the Indians.
Thank you, John, for your precious time. Now let's take a look at how the social media has covered the issue.
Dr. Bishnu Hari Nepal has predicted that the U.S. military would not leave Afghanistan as far as their interests are safe there. Yasser Karavan has pointed out that generations of Afghan people hate foreign forces on their soil. This account has lashed out at the American imperialist wars, underlining that Washington's call to end the violence in Afghanistan is a ruse to get out of the agreement with Taliban. This account believes that US should withdraw its forces from all the countries in the region, be it Syria, Iraq, or Afghanistan.
And with this, we come to the end of our episode on the alternatives for US forces after withdrawal from Afghanistan. We will meet again next week. So till then, take care and bye-bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Racial justice advocates accused Louisiana State Police of attempting to cover up the fatal 2019 arrest of an unarmed black motorist whom troopers stunned, punched, kicked, dragged face down on the pavement and left handcuffed on the ground for more than 9 minutes after the Associated Press published video it obtained of the deadly encounter. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading Tortured to Death. Video showing fatal Louisiana arrest of unarmed black man sparks outrage. Stay tuned for the details, please. Racial justice advocates accused Louisiana State Police of attempting to cover up the fatal 2019 arrest of an unarmed black motorist whom troopers stunned, punched, kicked, dragged face down on the pavement and left handcuffed on the ground for more than 9 minutes after the Associated Press published video it obtained of the deadly encounter. The AP reports Louisiana State Police LSP officials initially told the relatives of the Ronald Green that the 49-year-old barber died from injuries sustained in a car crash that occurred as he led troopers on a high-speed chase following an unspecified traffic violation outside Monroe on May 10, 2019. However, the AP obtained police body camera footage that authorities withheld for 2 years, showing Green desperately apologizing as white officers brutally arrest him, repeatedly shooting him, but a stun gun as he raises his hands in surrender inside his stopped car. As Green is attacked in his vehicle, he pleads, "I'm your brother. I'm scared. I'm scared." The officers identified in a wrongful death lawsuit as Troopers Dakota Moss and Corey York and Master Trooper Chris Hollingsworth then violently remove Green from the car and tackle him to the ground, where he's seen lying face down as he's placed in a chokehold and punched in the face by one officer while another calls him stupid. Green apologizes but is stunned again, before being handcuffed and shackled and then dragged across the ground. He's left there alone for over 9 minutes. The troopers offered no medical assistance despite Green's agonized moans. Several minutes later in the footage, Green is seen lying limp and unresponsive with blood flowing from his face and head. An ambulance eventually arrives and Green is shackled onto a gurney and taken to hospital where he was pronounced dead shortly after arrival. In a separate body camera microphone, a recording previously obtained by the AP, Hollingsworth boasts to colleagues that he bit Green, choked him and everything else trying to get him under control, Hollingsworth says in the audio recording. He was spitting blood everywhere and all of a sudden he just went limp. Last September, Hollingsworth died following a single vehicle highway accident hours after learning he would lose his job over his role in Green's death. According to a wrongful death lawsuit filed by Green's family, the trooper's excessive use of force left their victim beaten, bloodied, and in cardiac arrest. They murdered him. It was set out. It was planned, Green's mother, Mona Hardin, told the AP recently. He didn't have a chance. Rony didn't have a chance. He wasn't going to live to tell about it. Lee Merritt, an attorney for Green's family, said the footage has some of the same hallmarks of George Floyd video, the length of it, the sheer brutality of it. He apologized in an attempt to surrender. This was a malicious attack on the side of the road on a fully surrendered man. Earlier this month, former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was found guilty of murdering Floyd, an unarmed black man, by placing his knee on his neck for more than 9 minutes last May. The ACLU of Louisiana said bluntly that Ronald Green was tortured to death by officers who denied him life-saving aid for more than 9 minutes. According to Union Parish Coroner Rennie Smith, Green's death was accidental and caused by cardiac arrest. A report from Smith's office makes no mention of police violence. However, a medical report obtained by the AP shows an emergency room doctor almost immediately doubted a trooper's claim that Green died on impact after crashing his car into a tree. Noting the bloodied, bruised, and stunned corpse, the doctor wrote, does not add up. Ranking LSP officers initially claimed that the trooper's use of force against Green was justified, calling it awful but lawful. However, Andrew Scott, a use of force expert and former Boca Raton, Florida police chief, told the AP that while Green was not without fault, his treatment by the troopers was malicious, sadistic, and completely unnecessary. Former Baltimore Police Lieutenant Charles Key, another use of force expert, said the troopers were just dead wrong to leave Green beaten and shackled on the ground for so long. You don't leave somebody lying on the ground, particularly after you've had this fight, Key told the AP. The training has been for a number of years that as soon as you get someone under control, you put them on the other side to facilitate their breathing, and particularly this guy, because he was very heavy. LSP officials waited 474 days before opening an investigation into the events of May 10, 2019, according to the AP report. In its statement, LSP said that premature public release of investigative files and video evidence in this case is not authorized and undermines the investigative process and compromises the fair and impartial outcome. Of the surviving officers named in the lawsuit, York was suspended without pay for 50 hours for improper deactivation of his body camera. Dimas was arrested in February for allegedly brutalizing another black man following a high-speed chase in May 2020 and then bragging about what he inflicted on his victim. Democratic Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards last year allowed Green's family to view the suppressed footage while promising to make the footage public following an investigation. The Washington Post reports the U.S. Department of Justice said recently that it is conducting an ongoing investigation of Green's death involving the DOJ's Civil Rights Division and the FBI. Merritt told the Post he was heartened by the fact that the Justice Department has been more active during the Biden administration. The trend that I'm seeing in 2021 in particular, it gives me hope, in this case, he said.
Economic divide.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavatapai. It has been weeks since the Iran nuclear talks began in Vienna, and we have heard nothing but Iran wanting the sanctions to be removed by the U.S. Yet, that has not happened. What has happened? Well, the talks have continued. Is that a sign of progress? That's what we're going to try to find out in today's program. Coming up, the latest on the Vienna talks. Where do things stand? Have the talks hit an impasse? What are the new U.S. excessive demands all about, like the destruction of centrifuges? Also, a review of terminologies that we are now all too familiar with, imposed, reimposed, and relabeled. These are what Iran's lead negotiator has requested to be removed time and again. But the European side and the U.S. are not listening. And finally, even if there is a deal, will it work? Will Iran gain the economic benefits that it should enjoy? Plus, U.S. governors and state legislators able to go around the State Department? That's an exclusive economic divide that's going to be coming up later. It has been weeks since the Iran nuclear talks began in Vienna. One would think that there should be something that should have come out of the talks. Yet the only sign of any kind of success is that the talks are continuing. At the same time, there are signs that the talks have hit an impasse. Here are some key issues pointing to that direction. The U.S. wants the destruction of Iran's new generation centrifuges, in return for a temporary suspension of some of the sanctions related to the nuclear deal. This is while under the JCPOA, Iran's advanced centrifuges, including the IR-4, IR-6, and IR-9, must be stored away under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency and not destroyed. The new demands have been put forward while the U.S. has not even agreed to remove all the JCPOA-related sanctions.
We are, though, nonetheless, pleased that Iran has continued to agree to engage in discussions, in direct discussions with us and with our partners on how we move forward and what is needed to allow us to move back into the JOPCA so that we're part of it again, that we should have never gotten out of it, in my view, without us making concessions that we're just not willing to make.
Washington is also complicating the talks by insisting on keeping in place 500 anti-Iran sanctions. This would prevent Iran from benefiting from the economic privileges offered under the JCPOA. This will also get in the way of Iran normalizing its trade relations with the rest of the world in contravention of Article 29 of the deal. In this Q&A segment, we have with us Koichiro Tanaka. He's a professor at the Graduate School for Media and Governance at Keio University. He's also a joint board member and president, and he's a senior analyst and head of the Iran program. Mr. Tanaka, welcome. First, was the idea of classifying the Iran sanctions into removable, negotiable, and non-removable. Then came the reimposed, imposed, and relabeled idea, which basically was a hurdle regarding the sanctions. This came before the centrifuge destruction demand. Is the U.S. trying to buy time, or is it trying to get as much sanctions to remain in place, which Iran has rejected all of them outright?
Well, regarding the sanctions, I think that there are plenty of sanctions in place as of today that would keep Iran out from the or away from the international trade normalization process. So the Americans don't actually need all those, but still they are looking for the things back at home, meaning that they are trying to say satisfy their own people, including the members of the Congress, that this is not the simple return to the old JCPOA that existed between 2015 to early 2017. For that sake, I believe the United States, the current administration in Washington, would continue to deal with the matters as they wish.
Okay, we appreciate that, Mr. Tanaka. All right, the U.S. has exerted the most severe sanctions, as the U.S. Secretary of Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, stated, like in this instance.
As previously announced by the president, we are announcing additional sanctions against the Iranian regime as a result of the attack on U.S. and allied troops. First, the president is issuing an executive order authorizing the imposition of additional sanctions against any individual owning, operating, trading with, or assisting sectors of the Iranian economy, including construction, manufacturing, textiles, and mining.
Well, here, the Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, explains the U.S. state of mind on Iran as seen through the lens of the former president, Donald Trump.
I believe President Trump, unfortunately, does not have good advisors. He's been waiting for Iranian government's collapse since he withdrew from the nuclear deal. At that time, John Bolton promised him that maximum pressure will bring us to our knees within a few months. Now the United States can come back to the negotiating table, but unfortunately, the suggestions by Macron and by Abe and others have all fallen onto deaf ears because President Trump, as I told you, has been convinced that we are about to collapse.
It's time now for a quick break here on Economic Divide, but do stay tuned. There's plenty more coming up in just a short while. The Iran nuclear talks in Vienna are still ongoing. After weeks of talks, some fundamental yet very simple questions are asked. Are they moving forward? Are the talks deadlocked? Has the U.S. agreed to lift all the sanctions? Well, the answer to all those questions is a resounding maybe. That points to the fact that perhaps there is not a clear picture that is emerging from the talks in order to get an idea of what is actually going on.
We negotiate behind the tables, not through media. The positions taken in the media is something, the real positions on the table is something else.
But what could that real position that is something else be? Iran has said that the U.S. needs to lift all of its sanctions. First, let's take a look at how the different ways the U.S. wants to keep sanctions in place. Now, it has asked for separating sanctions into imposed, reimposed, or relabeled categories. Now, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has been quick to point out to the U.S. to not categorize or differentiate between the sanctions, since if the shared goal is for Iran to return to full compliance with the deal, all sanctions need to be lifted. Now, at the bottom of this tweet, as you can see over here, all Trump sanctions were anti-JCPOA and must be removed without distinction between arbitrary designations. But these three descriptions actually came after another three key categories of sanctions were introduced prior. They were called removable ones, and then negotiable ones, and non-removable. The idea of classifying the Iran sanctions into removable, negotiable, and non-removable was seriously at odds with what the Americans said at the beginning. What is the U.S. aim? To categorize sanctions so as to have leverage and control on Iran. Well, that is at least the way it looks. Iran has been clear on these futile U.S. efforts from the beginning. After an offer for talks from the U.S. was made initially, Iran renewed its call for the U.S. to lift all sanctions imposed by the former President Donald Trump, as relayed by the Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif. In a tweet, he stated that Iran would immediately reverse its retaliatory measures if the U.S. unconditionally and effectively lifted all sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled by Trump. Now, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, in line and step with Iran's foreign minister, also relayed the same message, almost verbatim, as seen here in this tweet. Media spinning can't change the fact that, unlike the U.S., Iran remains a JCPOA participant. The only U.S. path back to the deal is full compliance and effective removal of all imposed, reimposed, and relabeled sanctions. Well, there is also this notion that the sanctions that the former U.S. President Donald Trump imposed will take a long time for them to be removed. Well, let's hear from the horse's mouth about the imposition and the removal of sanctions.
I look forward to the day when sanctions can be finally lifted and Iran can become a peaceful, prosperous, and productive nation. That can go very quickly. It can be tomorrow. It can also be in years from now.
Tomorrow, years from now? He never did give an answer that one can really rely on, but Iran's lead negotiator, Basar Afshi, gave us a realistic view on that when asked by our very own Homolesky. This was his answer on April 9th.
And just on while we were speaking about the sanctions, illegal discussions, what kind of sanctions removal is being talked about? Is it removal with guarantees that they cannot be reimposed, or a temporary suspension, or suspension that requires extension?
Well, you know, we have to back go model in the JCPOA. They are sanctions which should be terminated, and the U.S. president has the authority to terminate them, so that they should be obviously terminated through executive orders. And there are sanctions which are actually the result of the Congress, legislation. For them, the president could only waive. And this has been mentioned in the JCPOA. So we want all those sanctions be reversed. Whatever imposed during this Trump administration, whatever imposed or reimposed or relabeled during Trump administration, and whatever is mentioned in the JCPOA should be lifted, and they should reverse whatever has been done. And I think the Americans know best how to do that.
Well, at this stage, the talks, though still ongoing, have not revealed any true advancements. We have learned about the excessive demands that have been made by the U.S., which is the perfect time, actually, to ask this from one of our guests who's going to join us for this segment. John McLean is a Tokyo-based independent foreign policy and financial analyst. He's also a Japan-focused coordinator. He's the author of a U.S. declaration of war on Iran. Okay, John, welcome The Iran nuclear talks in Vienna is risking falling apart due to the U.S. excessive demands. We learned that the U.S. has relayed that to the Europeans, wanting the destruction of Iran's new generation centrifuges in return for a temporary suspension of some of the sanctions related to the nuclear deal. Why would it make such a demand, knowing that Iran would reject it, and not to mention that this could actually derail the talks altogether?
Well, I've seen these reports about the U.S. making demands that centrifuges be destroyed before there's any return to the JCPOA agreement. As a general comment, there has to be negotiations first, and then there has to be an agreement on what the two sides are going to do. So if Iran ultimately, under an agreement, has to restrict or maybe even destroy, but somehow restrict or limit centrifuges or other facilities, then these things should come under the supervision of the IAEA.
I have come here to do business, but I doubt that there is the same seriousness in the other side. If the U.S. is serious, they should be prepared to lift all sanctions that they have imposed or reimposed against Iran. And after verification, we certainly go back to full compliance. Now we are working on the measures that both sides should take. Once we have done with this, and once we know exactly what the U.S. should do and what Iran should do, then we have to work on the question of sequence and verification. This round of negotiations is the time for the U.S. to present the list, and I hope that I can go back to Tehran with the list of sanctions which should be lifted. The most important question is to talk about the sequence, because we have already talked about measures. Well, on the details of negotiations, of course, sanctions are a very serious question, and actually the most important question for us. We have already entered into the different aspects of that. It's a very complicated issue, and as you know, sanctions have different categories, and we have to deal with all of them. The problem or the challenge is about the sequence of who should come first, to full compliance. All sanctions should be lifted. All sanctions which are mentioned in the JCPOA, and any new sanctions imposed after the adoption day of the JCPOA, including everything during Trump administration.
For them to lift it all at once, and it's an important issue.
But will they do it?
They have undertaken to do it, but we say that they must put it into action, turn their commitments into action. The current sticking point, number one sticking point, is U.S. to lift its sanctions, all its sanctions, not just the primary sanction against Iran, but also lift all its sanctions of long-term jurisdiction in nature, involving the third-party entities and the individuals. China maintained that all U.S. sanctions should be lifted immediately. May it concern sanction against Iran or its long-term jurisdiction measures affecting third country entities and individuals, including those on Chinese. So we are looking forward to such a drafting exercise. So it's just axiomatic that U.S. should abolish all its unilateral sanctions against Iran, as well as any third party in the first place, before Iran move to implement the provisions on the JCPOA accordingly.
It's time now to take a look at our info news section, where we review some of the top stories that we deemed to highlight for this program. Our first story concerns U.S. Big Pharma. A film actually came out highlighting what they have done. The firms use